We welcome back Craig Wiener, supposedly retired Valpo professor, right? I'm not sure he's fully retired, nor do we want him to be fully retired, but he is coming into his second week of leading Living Word, and we're so grateful for that. So thank you, Fred.
Thank you. We'll open with the prayer that I've been using all of last week and will use all of this week. It's a prayer in the ELW for those seeking deeper knowledge of God. And this has become my new favorite prayer just in the past week. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. Gracious and holy God, give us diligence to seek you, wisdom to perceive you, and patience to wait for you. Grant us, O God, a mind to meditate on you, eyes to behold you, ears to listen for your word, a heart to love you, and a life to proclaim you, through the power of the Spirit of Christ. Amen.
Amen.
I think that sort of sums it all up about what one wishes and hopes and prays for when trying to do some theology. The title up on the kiosk of my entire series is The Role of Love in the Life of Ree, R-E hyphen, because the theme for the summer's reflection did a bit of morphing and started out many months ago on the subject of reforming and renewal and rebirth and many things, and then it morphed into the unity of love. And so since I had already sent stuff in about I added love. And now I'm doing sessions mostly last week and this week on love and the way that love plays a crucial role in renewing us. So the Colossians text, putting on love which binds everything together in perfect unity, is sort of the key text for exploration, and how does love tie everything together is, in a way, our question. I've been saying in all my sessions how I've tried to prepare not only by studying from the Bible, but by reading a lot of fiction, because that's what I do anyway. I'm a novel junkie, and in retirement you get to do that. And novelists, good writers, see things the rest of us don't necessarily see, and they can teach us a great deal about things, and so many novelists write about love. One of the texts that I have been pondering with some friends, a couple of whom are in this room, over the last months is from a 1989 novel by the British author Julian Barnes, who's written many books about love, or at least he believes they are about love. My friends and I debate whether he understands love, but in any case, Julian Barnes wrote a novel 30 years ago called The History of the World in 10 and a half chapters, and it's way too complicated to try to tell you the entire premise, and it would take time, but he says that love is the one absolutely necessary thing that human beings must do in order to be genuinely human. And I'm going to read you just a brief paragraph, and I can't set it up for you because it would just take too long, but hopefully this little paragraph will help think about what are the stakes as we attempt as human beings to love. He goes, I will preface this by saying, he talks about all kinds of love that there are in the world, and he says he can't recommend any one of them over another, and he doesn't know, for example, if prudent or reckless love is the better, or or careful love is. But then he writes this. I can't tell you who to love or how to love, but I can tell you why to love. Because the history of the world, which only stops at the half house of love to bulldoze it into rubble, is ridiculous without it. The history of the world becomes brutally self-important without love. Our random mutation is essential because it is unnecessary. Love won't change the history of the world, but it will do something much more important: teach us to stand up to history, to ignore its chin-out strut. I don't accept your terms, love says. Sorry, you don't impress, and by the way, what a silly uniform you're wearing. Of course, we don't fall in love to help out with the world's ego problem, yet this is one of love's surer effects. Love and truth, that's the vital connection, love and truth. Have you ever told so much truth as when you were first in love? Have you ever seen the world so clearly? Love makes us see the truth, makes it our duty to tell the truth. And I'm going to stop there because going further would introduce issues I don't want to try to deal with. But I believe the premise is absolutely necessary that we love. And it is our way of standing up to history, standing up, among other things, to the historical reality of our finitude and our mortality. I'm not so certain that love allows us either to see or to tell the truth, because love is also famous for turning us into liars and for hiding the truth from us, and for making us do all manner of things that don't seem to fit well with the truth. What is love? The Greeks have a bunch of words for it, and if you ever go to seminary, you have to learn them all. And then C.S. Lewis adds a fourth, and so we have eros, and we have philia, and we have agape, and then C.S. Lewis adds storge, parental love. So we have the passionate love, the friendship love, and the sacrificing love of God, and then that curious love of parents and grandparents, one of which we're going to test out in a certain way today. The Hebrew Bible has only one word for love, ahav. Although there are other words to speak of the beloved, a word that's related to the name of David. David comes from a word for beloved or a word related to affection, or the very word for friend, roeh. In the Song of Songs, it becomes a way, rayati, to talk about my beloved. But there's really only one word for love, ahav. And it means we have to do a lot of examination before we know what kind of love we're talking about in the Bible. And just for fun, I went through, you can do this with a computer, so this was no great labor-intensive thing I had to do, but in 0.3 seconds, I can find every text on love in the Bible with my computer hermeneutica program. And it's very interesting to me to see which are the first 10 or so instances of the word for love in the Bible. So I'll share just the ones from Genesis, and there aren't that many. And the first one does not happen until Genesis 22, the text that's going to preoccupy us for most of today if I get going here. God said, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I will show you. So be careful what or whom you love. You may have to give it up. This session has me so anxious that I'm actually battling a bloody nose. I have blown a gasket. The second one, Genesis 24. Then Isaac brought her, Rebecca, into his mother Sarah's tent. He took Rebecca, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. There's a curious connection. The way to be comforted over the loss of your mother is to love this woman whom you've never seen. Next is Genesis 25. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And you know what kind of trouble is going to come from that. One parent loving one child and one the other. There are a whole bunch more references to love in Genesis 25. They all refer to the way Isaac loved the stuff that Esau prepared him. So love is also taste, desire. Genesis 29. Jacob loved Rachel, so he said to Laban, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter Rachel. But he doesn't get Rachel, as you know. On the wedding night, sister Leah gets slipped into the tent. And so we read a few verses later, after Jacob has to put in 7 more years to have Rachel. So Jacob went in to Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. Leah conceived and bore a son, and she named him Reuben, for she says, because the Lord has looked on my affliction, surely now my husband will love me. So we have our ways of trying to buy love. And we have our ways of living with people who won't love us because they love someone else more. Genesis 34. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the region. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the region, saw her, he seized her and lay with her by force, and his soul was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob. He loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. There's love, but with things quite a bit out of order. And finally, the last one in Genesis. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a long robe with sleeves, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. So love can generate hate. Every one of these texts is problematic. Love is not a pure and solely good thing. In any one of these texts, there's a mix of trouble each time. And so we have to work hard to figure out what is genuine love and what is merely thirsting and hungering after what I want to have or to hold, etc. So I got it into my head today that we would start this week when we're doing dialogue among faith traditions to talk about a story that is important to all three of the Abrahamic religious traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and look at the story of the Akedah, the binding of Isaac in Genesis chapter 2. Chapter 22. One of the most difficult stories in all of the scriptures, and I have collected all kinds of stuff. You see my podium here is full of all sorts of paper that I may or may not read to you, but we're going to read this story. I'm going to read it aloud so that we have it in our ears as well as on papers in front of you if you have a Bible. And then we're going to have a bit of a discussion about it. I want to hear what questions this story raises in your mind, either old ones or ones that may have occurred to you in your hearing today. And then we're going to try to wrestle with this story. I'm going to do something that we'll talk about later in the week when we talk about the story of Jacob wrestling with the night stranger. We're going to do what many people, including Martin Luther, have said you do when you run into a tough story. You wrestle it, as Jacob did the night stranger. And you say to that story, I will not let you go until you bless me. Just a quick word of preface about the possible insanity of doing this. One of the people that I have read in order to prepare for today is Leon Cass, a Jewish scholar at the University of Chicago who comes out of a medical background but has written this amazing work on the book of Genesis called The Beginning of Wisdom. And let me just read to you a sentence at the beginning of Leon Cass's work on this story. No story in Genesis is as terrible, as powerful, as mysterious, as elusive as this one. It defies easy and competent interpretations, and despite all that I shall have to say about it, and he has a lot to say about it, it continues to baffle me. Indeed, my approach seems, even to me, to be too shallow, precisely because I am attempting to be reasonable about this awesome and shocking story. And so, I had already put this on a schedule before I read Cass, and I thought, what have I done? So, the story. I'm reading from the NRSV. After these things, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place far away. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac said to his father Abraham, Father. And he said, here I am, my son. He said, The fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God himself will provide the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. When they came to the place God had showed him, Abram built an altar there and laid the wood in order. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to kill his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here I am. He said, Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham looked up and saw a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, The Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will indeed bless you, and I will make your offspring as numerous as the stars of heaven, and as the sand that is on the seashore, and your offspring shall possess the gate of their enemies. And by your offspring shall all the nations of the earth gain blessing for themselves, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. All right, without any other commentary from the reader, I can offer in abundance and commentary from all manner of other folks as well. What mysteries and questions sneak into your mind or whack you upside the head when you hear this, when you read this? What does this story do to you? And please use your outside voice so that
this story disturbs me. I mean, not as much now as it used to, but I had the experience of teaching a Sunday school class of fifth graders, and this was the lesson for the day. And I got some real, real serious questions from those fifth grade boys. They wanted me to say, well, do you mean God wanted Abraham to kill his son? And I can talk about, well, it was a test and God was, but I didn't have a good answer. I felt like I was kind of treading water. So I went to the youth pastor at that church and I told her, and she had been an elementary school teacher. And she said, yeah, we're thinking about taking that out of the curriculum. And I think that would be a good idea. Even as an adult, it still disturbs me. I think of the Aztecs and the Mayans and the Incas, that I think they had child sacrifice. And I think of the story from Greek mythology where Agamemnon sacrificed his daughter going to Troy in the Trojan War. And so it gives me a sense that God is, in this story, God is some kind of primitive or something. And I don't know, it disturbs me.
Yeah, I would question all kinds of things about folks who would put this story into a curriculum for children. This is not a bedtime story for children. Maybe even a Sunday school. But anyway, but as you say, the history of the world is filled with stories of not merely casual sacrifice of children, but systemic, institutionalized sacrifice of children.
Yeah.
And we know it from the Aztecs, as you say. We know it from Greek legends and mythology and history. We know it from all over the place. But we also know it from the Bible, King Manasseh, in the time just before the exile, is said to have sacrificed his children to Moloch because there was so much danger confronting the nation that maybe this might help. We also know from archaeological digs that all through the ancient Near East, underneath the foundations of the city gates, you always find infant skeletons. And it wasn't just that they used that as a convenient burial site for the babies that happened to die that week. You give up what is most precious to you to secure the most vulnerable part of your defense system, the city gates. Exodus 22 says this: "You shall not delay to make offerings from the fullness of your harvest and from the outflow of your presses. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and with your sheep. 7 days it shall remain with its mother. On the eighth day you shall give it to me." And of course, later on, Torah says, "But for human children, you substitute a certain kind of animal, depending upon what you can afford, and that will suffice," as is the case in Luke's gospel when Jesus' parents, like everybody else, goes to make the sacrifice on the eighth day after the child has been with its mother for 7 days, and then you have to go present it. Those poor people could sacrifice birds. So every human culture has got it in its head, or almost every human culture, that this is a necessary behavior, the sacrifice of children for the preservation of the people. So that's one set of issues.
I'm stirred into thinking, aren't we doing that now?
Could you speak up just a little?
I'm stirred into thinking, aren't we doing that now with separation of children from their parents at the border for the sake of one viewpoint that would argue that we need to secure our borders, so we're enacting that right now politically?
Yeah, the question for the recording, are we doing that now? Perhaps at the border in the camps where we're separating children from their parents. I would say we sacrifice children in countless ways without burning them on altars or cutting their hearts out on Mayan sacrificial altars or in Agamemnon's fashion or whatever. We have countless ways to make children pay for our sins and make them the sacrifices whose lives are trashed because of the things that we adults do. And it goes all the way from people who sell their children for drugs, which is not unknown in our world, to sending young people off to fight our wars, wars that we're not even completely sure what they're about, but we're willing to send off our 18 and 19 and 20 year olds to die for our anger. So it's simply a fact of life that we sacrifice children and their well-being and their lives for our stuff. And maybe some of you have been sacrificed as a child, used and abused for someone else's foolishness. Theological questions that this may raise for some of you.
I think the part of this reading that is most at odds with how I understand God's character is right in that first verse where God says, I'm going to test Abraham.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because that sort of calls into question all sorts of things about God and God's omniscience and God's benevolence. And all these things of, like, to test someone is like a form of manipulation, right?
Yeah, that's a hard one all by itself without even,
right?
Without even being child sacrifice.
Yeah.
The fact that God is going to do things that are merely a test.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a major story in Job of God putting someone to the test by sticking the trial attorney on him and destroying his life just to see how he'll act. How will a person? Will a person still sing hymns at Vespers if I kill all his children?
Well, I tend to think that the stories in the Bible reflect how we see God, not how God is. So, and they evolve as the people evolve in their understanding. And so this story, as you were saying about the different cultures, reflects the people's understanding that if they sacrificed what was most precious, they would be safe, rather than a reflection of God needed that in order to make the people safe.
In other words, I mean, we always have to ask this, what kind of story is this? And to put what you've said in just a simple formulation, one of the questions is it theology? Is it our attempt to say something that will help us understand God or say what we think God is? Or is this a transcript of something you could have caught on videotape if you'd been there? Is this history, as we understand history?
The only one who can tell that story is Abraham, so he wasn't caught on videotape. So it's hard to say that.
Yeah.
Abraham told someone that this happened to him.
I couldn't hear.
Maybe that. Abraham told someone this story.
Oh yeah.
And so maybe Abraham was. Had a lesson to teach, or I don't know, but I...
Right, we have all sorts of ways, but one way or another, the question is it theology or is it history?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What I think you're going to get to this eventually is, what about when God does it to his own son?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and that's a very big question about Christianity. Is Christianity a child sacrifice cult?
Right.
Yeah.
In which, you know, God says, well, somebody's got to die. I guess instead of killing all the rest of these people, I'll just kill my son. That's a very common version of what Christianity means. But I will admit it's one that I find phony and abhorrent.
Yeah.
And I will eventually talk more about that, although time's moving quickly, and yes.
Well, to kind of go with that, I never noticed before that it says, and on the third day.
Yeah.
And I noticed that as you read it. So there's that.
Yeah. Yeah, and all sorts of, I presume many of you are aware that there are countless commentaries on this story, and every single detail has been probed. And the allegorical meaning of every single detail and the symbolic meaning of every, including on the third day, you know, and I have so much material here about every little detail has been used over the course of the centuries in both Judaism and Christianity. Because we might not get to it just for fun, I will tell you one of the stuff that I have, one of the things I have with me is material from Louis Ginsberg's The Legends of the Jews, which collects a lot of the tradition about biblical stories. And just for example, you wouldn't believe all the material that's out there just about the ram that is caught in the thicket. And the ram, the use of the ram's body parts after the sacrifice was finished, and all the many things that this ram got turned into, including parts of it became Elijah's girdle, and other parts of it became musical instruments used by later generations to sing the Psalms, etc., etc. So every single detail, including the third day. Let me ask you, I mean, lots of hands are going up. Let me ask you this question. If you were Abraham, how would you have responded? And secondly, given what you know about Abraham to this point in Genesis, how did you expect him to respond?
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that he talks back to God when God says he's going to destroy Sodom.
Right.
And why doesn't he intercede for his son in protest?
Right.
I mean, I see that if it was embedded in the culture that child sacrifice might be expected from God, then maybe there's that. But, like, come on, Abraham, you were bold to speak back to God earlier. Why didn't you do it here?
Right.
Well, maybe Abraham was testing God. He did say to his servant, God will provide.
Yeah.
So he was like, okay.
Everybody points out that there are all sorts of statements that Abraham makes that he doesn't know, he's bluffing, right, but they turn out to be true. And as though he's got some sort of innate sense that he thinks maybe this is crazy too, but God's got some way, God's going to work this out. So don't worry, God will provide, and sure enough, God provides. But he's bluffing. He's just trying to keep his son from
freaking out,
from panicking. Abraham gets in God's face.
Yeah.
Just a couple chapters earlier, and will not put up, and in fact says, God, think about it.
Yeah.
What reputation will you have left if you kill the innocent along with the guilty? Then you're nothing, God.
Yeah.
Your reputation is baloney. And God says, okay. Yeah. What was I thinking? You're right. If there's innocent people there, I won't kill them. Because that would be terrible. And people who have studied that, including Leon Cass and others, have written that in this very test, God has as much at stake as Abraham. Because just think about it. What if Abraham says, hell no, God, I won't go. I won't do this. You're nuts. Well, then who does God have left? This is the chosen person to bring blessing to all the families of the earth. Does God start over and say, oh, well, I guess I picked the wrong dude back there in Ur of the Chaldees. Let me go find someone else and do plan B. Or what if Abraham goes ahead and kills the boy, not recognizing that the second voice has the same authority as the first, and he kills the child, then what? God risks hugely, according to Cass anyway, in this story. And God's own reputation. Does God really want to be known for demanding the death of children?
Fred, up here. How does Abraham know the voices from God?
Great point. So if you heard voices in the night that said, get up, go kill your child, this is God speaking.
Wow.
What would you do? Or if your friend came to you and said, my God just told me to kill my child.
Mm-hmm. Get him to the ER.
Yeah. This happens, you know.
CPS.
God still tells people to put their children in the clothes dryer, yeah, or to drown them, yeah, mm-hmm, to get rid of their sins and keep them from doing evil. Yeah. Or does God? Mm-hmm. Where do those voices come from? That question also occurred to the ancients. And so in Ginsberg's The Legends of the Jews, that question is put into the mouth of Satan. So let's see if I can find this without too much trouble and read to you. So on the road, as during the 3 days, as they're on the road, Satan came and appeared to Abraham in the figure of a very aged man, humble and contrite of spirit, and said to him, art thou silly or foolish that thou goest to do this thing to thine only son? God gave thee a son in thy latter days and thy old age, and wilt thou go slaughter him? Who did not commit it? This one who did not commit any violence? The Lord would not do any such thing or command such evil. You must be hearing some other voice. So that temptation is put on the lips of Satan in the old legends. And then Satan appears to Isaac as well in the figure of a young man, comely and well-favored, saying to him, dost thou not know that thy silly old father bringeth thee to slaughter this day for no purpose? Now, my son, do not listen to him, for he's a silly old man. And let not thy precious soul and beautiful figure be lost from the earth. And so Isaac, in the legends, Isaac and Abraham discuss these two encounters that each of them has had, and they have their way to discern that both of these come from Satan. And they pledge obedience. Isaac agrees to be sacrificed. Abraham agrees to go through with the sacrifice. So we are not the first people who thought, maybe this sounds crazy.
Another perspective, if you put, instead of the father, if you put the mother in the picture, I guess I see a different yeah, outcome, and I see the mother saying, take me, God. Yeah. Don't take my son. Mm-hmm. And so, if there was more of a feminist view of it, I see that it could be a totally different challenge and outcome and beliefs. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For the sake of the recording, the question is, where is the mother? And what would the mother have said about all this? And what if we bring the perspectives of the mother and of feminism in general to this? And of course, this has also been done by my mother's Phyllis Pribble, who has a famous lecture that's out there that actually was first given at Valparaiso University as one of our named lectures. And her name for this story is The Sacrifice of Sarah. And you've raised several points that are worth holding up, one of which is, wouldn't either parent, the mother or the father, I mean, I think this is what I would hope I would do if somebody said, you must do this. I would hope I would could say, oh no, if you're going to kill somebody, kill me. Because I can't and I won't do this. Kill me if you need to kill somebody. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine a genuinely healthy, loving mother or father that wouldn't have that thought first. Mm-hmm. Secondly, yes, there's something missing in this story, and many, many people, including all the way back to medieval commentaries, have focused on this. There's a bunch of facts in the beginning of the story that are simply not true. Mm-hmm. Right? Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love.
Uh-huh. What about Israel? Huh. Uh-huh.
Now, Phyllis Tribble's point is the only person for whom that set of facts is true is Sarah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Sarah is the only parent who has one son, mm-hmm. Isaac, whom she loves. Mm-hmm. Abraham already has two sons. Some of you may be familiar with the work of, sort of the foundational work in Jewish exegesis. A medieval French rabbi from the 11th century, who's commonly referred to as Rashi, which is a short for Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, who has the foundational commentary on Talmud and Tanakh on the Bible. And Rashi, let me just read to you what Rashi, the greatest of the ancient rabbis, biblical interpreter, says. The term, I got to teach a little bit of Hebrew. You're familiar with the term Hosanna?
Yeah.
Hosanna is not really a word of praise. It's an imperative version of the verb for save or deliver, yasha, with a particle on the end, na, which you put on the end of a request to make it polite and at least a tiny bit tentative. Would you please save us, O God? We don't deign to speak to you in crass imperatives, but please save us. Well, when God commands Abraham to go do this, go to the land that I will show you, there's a na on the end of the imperative. So that Rashi says, what God is really saying is, this is a request. And what Rashi says, what God really wants is, withstand this test for my sake, so that people will not say that the first trials that you had, namely not having a child for so long and having to go off to a place unknown and all of these other things and dealing with the wife-sister issue and having your wife almost taken away from you, but all these other tests didn't have any other reality. And then when God says, take your son, Abraham actually says to God, according to Rashi, I have two sons. And God said, thine only son. And Abraham said, well, the one is an only son to his mother, and the other is an only son to his mother. And God said, no, the one you love. But Abraham says, both of them do I love. But God said to him, Isaac. And why did he not reveal it to him, to Abraham, at the beginning? In order not to confuse him suddenly, lest his mind be distracted and disordered, and also to endear upon him the commandment and to give him a reward for each word. So that's some ancient Jewish commentary, and it's kind of hard to understand all the bits of it all by themselves, but this is meant to be a test. From the get-go, God doesn't really want this to happen. And God is only wanting to see, how far does Abraham fear me? Because of what we're doing this week, I want to make sure that you realize there's also a version of this story in the Quran. And I realized only when I got up here that I somehow neglected to print it, but I was able to take a picture of a file on my computer. And excuse me, so I'm going to read to you the version that's in the Quran in 37. Now wait a minute, my phone won't show me what. I'll just have to read it to you without telling you the exact reference for the moment. So Abraham prayed, O Lord, grant me a righteous son. So we gave him the good news of a clement son, a peaceful son. When he was old enough to go about with him, he said, O my son, I dreamed that I was sacrificing you. Consider, what do you think? He replied, Father, do as you are commanded. If God pleases, you will find me firm. When they submitted to the will of God, and Abraham laid his son down prostrate on his temple, we called out, O Abraham, you have fulfilled your dream. Thus do we reward the good that was indeed a trying test. So we ransomed him for a great sacrifice and left his hallowed memory for posterity. Peace be on Abraham. That is how we reward those who do good. He is truly among our faithful creatures. So Abraham passes the test, so does the son. Who is the son?
Ishmael.
The text does not say. But it would turn out to be, in the Quran, most likely Ishmael, the other son, Abraham's firstborn, because of what follows as a consequence of Abraham and Ishmael passing this test. Quran says, so we gave him the good news of Isaac, apostle, who is among the righteous, and we blessed him and Isaac. Among their descendants are some who do good, but some who wrong themselves. So Isaac is the gift that Abraham gets for passing the test that he and Ishmael passed together, both of them agreeing to be obedient. Leon Cass follows Rashi and makes a big deal of the nah. And he says we should really translate the opening sentences of this chapter as, Abraham, what if I asked you to sacrifice your son? Would you do it? And Abraham shows that he would. And so he passes the test. And Cass says that's the only way he could prove, that Abraham could prove that he was a worthy bearer of the covenant promise to be the father of a great nation. That he had to be willing to make this sacrifice, to give up what he loves most. And then, you know, there are a million other things that we could still talk about, but maybe this is the point at which we might begin to think about what, if anything, does a story like this mean for us? What, if anything, are we called to give up because we love it so? Are we called to give up anything nowadays? Do we see ourselves as needing to fear God enough that we really, truly would hand over into oblivion the most precious thing we have? And what do we have that is more precious than our children?
Well, nothing more precious than our children, but the first thing that comes to my mind when you ask that question is our privilege. And I think we have, different of us have different privilege, but I think that's what we're being asked to look at right now. And it would change everything for a lot of us and the world.
And maybe privilege in a certain way has this in common with giving up our children. I have some dear friends back home that lost a child yesterday. A couple that I married some years ago lost their son in a car accident. And I've not been able to have very much communication because of the way things work up here. But I've been pondering, because I know them, what it would be like to be in their shoes. And you know what's gone. If any of you have ever lost a child, you know that at least a part of what's gone is the future that you were living yourself into. Not just imagining, but the future you are living yourself into. That's what Abraham has been asked to give up. The future that he thought was sure, that he thought was the gift of God. And privilege can function the same way. We have what we have as a gift, and could we give it up? Which means, in part, can we recognize it as gift?
Well, it's also, you keep going back and forth, and I was interested that the Quran had faithful, that Abraham was faithful.
Right.
And we keep going back and forth. Was it a test of fear, that Abraham feared God, or is it a test that Abraham had faith?
Yeah.
And if you have faith, I mean, I don't happen to feel like I passed this test, but if you have faith, I can imagine you could lose anything.
Yeah.
And not that you wouldn't still grieve, you know, that future or that loss, but with faith, it's like, you know, you can go on.
Yeah. We're out of time, but you've raised another very important point, and that is we wrestled with what is love and what is loving behavior. But what is this fear? Now I know that you fear God. And that's what the test was about. What kind of fear is that? Is it merely dread? Is it merely this thing that's half loathing, that we're afraid of somebody for what they might do to us? It's got to be something else that's closer to some kind of profound, radical trust that even when our expected world is gone, I don't know what else to say, God is still with us. There is still a faithful bond, and God's love is still there for us, for lack of a better way to put it. Well, this is definitely a session with no conclusion. But we have wrestled. We have wrestled, and thank you so much for wrestling along. And maybe tomorrow, if there's time, we could have a few footnotes on what maybe a few of you who come back tomorrow thought about during the course of today on these subjects. So thank you very much.
Thank you.